Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Election 2020, the impact on taxes and federal spending. I'm Steve Abrahams, head of investment strategy at Amherst Pierpont. This is the third and final APS call on Election 2020 and its implications for the capital markets. And in this uncertain world, we wanted to turn to one of the most famous pair of certainties, taxes. In the first two national debates of this election season, the presidential and vice presidential debates, the words tax or taxes has come up at least 67 times. The two parties have different approaches with different impact on individuals, on companies, and on those niches of the economy where lobbyists really earn their pay. There's also the spending side of the equation. In fiscal 2019, the federal government collected nearly $3.5 trillion in revenue, but then spent almost $4.5 trillion, including more than $1 trillion, well over $1 trillion, on discretionary items like defense, education, and social services. And that includes $375 billion in interest on our debt, which, of course, raises the issue of managing that debt. I'm joined on today's call by Mark Mazur, the director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint effort of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. It is the preeminent think tank on all things related to tax. Mark has been the Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy at Treasury, economist to the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. He's been on the President's Council of Economic Advisors and the National Economic Council, among other spots. Mark, I'd like to welcome you to the call today.
Great to be here.
So, Mark, I'd like to take 20 or 30 minutes or so to kind of ask you about a couple of different topics, and then we're going to throw the call open to questions from the audience. For the audience, we don't have slides today, and then I'd like to remind you, folks in the audience, that you have a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen, and you can use that feature to ask questions at any time during the call. And then we'll draw from those questions during the audience Q&A. So before we actually dive into blue versus red, Mark, I'd like to ask you actually a little bit about the Tax Policy Center. It seems to have a very interesting background. So could you spend a minute or two on how and why the center got started?
Sure. So the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center was founded in 2002. And at the time, a number of policy observers thought that the federal government was becoming less and less forthcoming with information about tax policy issues. And so legislation in Congress typically was being considered without a lengthy run-up period where information could be gained about what the policy provisions that were being debated actually would do in terms of revenue and distribution of the costs and benefits. And so the Tax Policy Center has about 24 or so experts on federal tax and other fiscal policies, and like a growing set of expertise in state and local budget issues as well. And really what we try to do is educate the public, policymakers, and their staffs about important aspects of tax policy, in particular the trade-offs that are involved. We publish research reports, briefs, and blogs. We hold public events, and we do things like today's call. That's all part of our education mission. And you can find us at www.taxpolicycenter.org. We have a wealth of information there. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say, if you like what you see, there's a click here to donate button somewhere on the website.
Okay, that's fair. Thank you. So why don't we just dive into the red versus blue and try to get a sense, at least from, you know, your seat, on how the major parties really differ. I know the Democratic candidate, Joe Biden, has released, I guess, a somewhat detailed plan in February. And my first thought is, when you read that, is there some kind of overarching goal that glues the plan together, or is it really just a collection of separate pieces?
Sure, good question. So what the former vice president has done is issued a number of policy statements over the course of the year, and Tax Policy Center did an analysis of his proposals in March. We're updating that now, and we'll be releasing an updating analysis shortly. But basically what it does is a few things. One, it undoes some of the provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed in 2017, in particular the provisions that reduce taxes the most on high-income individuals. It also takes a page out of some of the Obama administration budgets, oh, actually more than one page, and looks at ways to increase taxes on capital income by increasing the tax rate on capital gains income for very high-income individuals, by taxing capital gains at death, counting that as a realization event, and so people would be unable to pass gains onto their heirs without income tax being collected. It would bring the estate tax back to 2009 parameters. So we do a lot on the capital income side for raising tax on high-income people. It would provide a number of tax credits for low- and middle-income people, would expand the child tax credit, make it refundable for a couple years, would expand the child and dependent care credit that provides benefits to people who pay for child care. It'd create a new tax credit for first-time home buyers, a tax credit for low-income renters, and would change the way that individuals get tax subsidies for investments in retirement accounts. They'd also raise payroll taxes on high-income individuals. And high-income is generally people with incomes of $400,000 a year and above. So when I say high-income, in the context of Biden, you should just think of $400,000 or more. And then on the business side of things, they would bring the corporate tax rate back up to 28%. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act reduced it from 35% to 21%. So we got halfway back to where it was. Would also impose a 15% minimum tax on companies' worldwide book income, and so companies wouldn't be able to show large book income without actually showing a substantial amount of taxable income, and would replace the current structure for taxing multinational firms by having a country-by-country minimum tax of 21%. So the U.S. rate would be 28%, but foreign subsidiaries would be taxed at 21%. And then a whole range of other tax credits and so on for encouraging energy efficient vehicles, green investments, renewable energy, things like that.
Got it. Okay, that's a lot. That's a big slew of proposals. I mean, if you step back for just a minute, in your experience, I mean, is there a philosophy behind that, or is that just a set of pragmatic answers to, you know, a bunch of separate questions?
So I think the philosophy behind it would be that high-income individuals and profitable corporations do not pay their fair share under the current system, and so the proposals by Vice President Biden would seek to address that. I think that is the underlying philosophy. There's a lot of other more sector-specific benefits or tax incentives for particular socially desirable activities, but I think the large philosophical underpinning is really that the tax system should be made more progressive and by having higher-income people and larger corporations paying more.
So there's a couple items you mentioned that at least catch my interest, because they focus on very specific items. you know, the combination of subsidies and credits. So some forms of energy get a break, others lose a break. I noticed in the proposals, commercial real estate loses some tax benefits. Student borrowers get a break. People without pensions get enrolled in IRAs. You mentioned home buyers and renters. Are those under the umbrella of socially desirable causes, or where do those particular items fit?
Yeah, I guess that's the way I would characterize them, that for each of those, there's an underlying story that there's a socially desirable course of action. So, for instance, first-time home buyers is intended to encourage people to buy a home because, you know, we know that homes are kind of a bedrock for wealth building in America, and so kind of getting that first step is important. Investing in retirement accounts is also important underpinning for long-term financial benefits for individuals, and so getting people into retirement plans and getting them in the habit of saving for retirement plans to like a defined contribution plan will help them in the long run, but it's kind of getting over that inertia. And then things like investments in green energy would help address the concern about climate change, as would taking away current law tax subsidies for fossil fuels. So I think each of these has a story behind it that would be characterized as advancing the social good. Obviously, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder whether that story is compelling or not.
Got it. Okay. So there's the plan, and I know TPC looked at the money that the plan raises, and those have actually gotten quite a lot of attention, especially with all of the recent debate over fiscal stimulus and things that Washington may be able to do to support the economy. What are the numbers in terms of money raised that you guys have put together?
So when we first analyzed this in March, we had an estimate that over the traditional 10-year budget window, the Biden plan would raise about $4 trillion. So we're in the process of reanalyzing the plan, and we'll be releasing results soon. But just qualitatively, the results will show that the Biden plan would raise a bit less over the 10-year budget window than our original estimate. And there are several reasons why. One is, Biden has added a bunch of new proposals, most of which are in the tax credit vein, so they would actually cost revenue. And two, the economy is not doing as well as it was earlier in the year when we did our first analysis, and so just adjusting the economic forecast for kind of where we are now would reduce the amount of revenue raised. But it still would be substantial amount of revenue.
Got it. Substantial amount of revenue above what current projections would anticipate.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. So that's a lot of money. What's the game plan for spending it?
So on the spending side, you know, obviously, in the political world, there is no shortage of ideas for spending tax revenue, and the Biden plans are no different. There's large investment plans for education, healthcare, infrastructure, and improving renewable energy outcomes, so addressing climate change. And there are probably others as well, but I think those are the main ones.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's look at the Republican side. Trump has a tax plan as well. What are the broad strokes there?
So there's a couple of things in the plans that President Trump has discussed. And tax policy, we'll be doing an analysis of the Trump plan as well. That's not quite as far along as the Biden plan. But first off, the president has proposed extending the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions that expire at the end of 2025. So All the individual income tax provisions are slated to expire at the end of 2025, as is the estate tax cuts that were passed in 2017. And they propose to extend those permanently. Then there's a number of less well-defined provisions, things to reduce the capital gain, the tax on capital gains income, whether it's by reducing the rate that's charged or adjusting the basis for inflation. A little bit unclear what they plan there. And then a number of specific tax credits for either onshoring production in the U.S. or exporting products. So it's kind of an American focus, I guess, made in America focus set of tax benefits, but also not all that well defined.
Okay. So those sound like some, you know, interesting, it's certainly continuing the tax approach that was defined in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. I mean, rolling back to that for a moment, it seemed that when that was getting put together, congressional Republicans ended up filling in a lot of details. Is it fair to ask whether congressional Republicans have the same tax plans that the president has sketched out?
So I think similar in that the continuation of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is probably the right intuitive framing for this. Both the president and Republicans in Congress would like to continue down that path, and there have been proposals in Congress to further reduce the corporate tax rate from 21% to 20%, say, or to a smaller number. And there have been proposals to reduce the tax rate on capital gains income. It's kind of similar to what the president has spoken about. And then a number of specific tax benefits for, you know, favorite activities that different members of Congress may have different ideas on what those are, but they all kind of go in the same direction of reducing taxes on favorite activities. And actually, one point that I left out is the president has spoken several times about reducing payroll taxes, but there's just about been no take-up in Congress on that idea on either Republican side or Democrat side of the aisle.
Okay. So they'll have to figure that one out as they go along as well.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about going from proposal to, you know, real practical implementation. And I guess I want to think a little bit about how these proposals end up playing out depending on some of the other results of the election, in particular whether we end up with a divided or a unified government. And there's obviously a lot of ways to cut that, but if I look at online markets, they give a fairly high probability to Democrats holding the House. So we'd end up with a divided government if Republicans, you know, either hold the Senate or the White House, and obviously there are other iterations of that. But for the purposes of what we're likely to see going ahead, does it matter whether government is divided or unified as to what, you know, you think could get done over the next couple of years?
Oh, sure. And just you can just think back to I guess two pretty high profile examples. In 2017, the Republicans passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act with just about no support from Democrats whatsoever. So having the control of the House, Senate, and the White House made that possible. And I guess if you go back a little further in time, during the Obama administration, the Affordable Care Act got passed with Democrat control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And so in a situation where the same party controls both the House and Senate and also controls the White House, you have a lot more scope for being able to deliver on things that president and the congressional leaders have proposed and want to see happen. Where there's divided government, it's just a lot harder. And, you know, one example would be in a current environment, the CARES Act was passed in March as kind of a stimulus bill slash relief act to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. And since then, even though the situation has probably not gotten completely resolved or even dramatically better, there's been no further movement. And I think part that just reflects the divided government, how hard it is sometimes to get a coalition together, even for things that people seem to want to do. It is just difficult to get the politics to align. So I guess the takeaway is just much easier to get your way if both houses of Congress and the presidency are held by the people of the same party.
Yeah. Well, if we end up with a divided government, are there any commonalities in the tax or the spending views of the two major parties that you think could lead to really material changes in those, you know, current tax or spending priorities? Is there any common ground that you see?
So there's probably some common ground. I think right now it's difficult to see because we're in the middle of a very contentious election season with an economy that's still working through a pandemic, and I guess also have a contentious Supreme Court nomination going on as well. So it's sort of hard in that environment to say, oh yeah, here's all the common ground. But that said, there are some things that I think people can coalesce around, and that would be things like support for working families, whether that is through the tax code, through like an expanded earned income tax credit for, say, workers without children, that was endorsed by former Speaker Ryan and former President Obama. So bipartisan support there. To things like place-based tax incentives. And so in the 1990s, we had empowerment zones. The 2017 version of that was opportunity zones. But you can imagine some coalition coming together around things like that. And then lastly, dealing with the education system. I think it is hard for people to look at the current system and think that, you know, this is the best that America can do. And so there's a lot of room for bipartisan approaches there as well.
Okay. And there's been, just based on the online numbers, some speculation about Democratic control of Congress and the White House. If that's the outcome, then there's a plan. But what actually gets executed?
Which is a good question, right? Because as a presidential campaign, you campaign on the ideas that are being generated during that time. But governing is different, and no matter who gets elected president and starts off their term on January 21st, 2021, they're going to have an economy that is likely in the doldrums. They're going to have at least vestiges of the COVID-19 pandemic to deal with. And so I think those become top-tier issues. And things like long-term plans to raise taxes on individuals and corporations probably take a bit of a backseat. And I think the way to think about this is similar to when President Obama started, that when he came into office, the economy was in the throes of the Great Recession. He had campaigned on doing things like expanding health care, and instead all the attention was placed on the Recovery Act, and that was the first thing that came up. Health care got done later, of course, but it moved from, you know, the top issue to, you know, not quite the top issue. And I suspect something like that would happen again here, that if Vice President Biden gets elected president, when he comes into office, he'll look around and take a sense of the situation and figure out what to do. But almost sure that would mean reprioritizing things that he may have promised during the campaign.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we have been talking over the last couple of weeks, I asked you about the economic impact of a lot of these tax plans, and I thought you had a very interesting answer to that. I mean, how big a difference do these kinds of party-to-party differences make in the trajectory of the economy?
Yes, I think they make maybe some differences on the margin, but they probably don't address the overall trajectory of the economy that much. Presidents get a ton of credit or blame for the performance of the economy during their term, and in reality, they can affect things around the edges. Kind of market forces are just too strong and too large to be affected by small tweaks, relatively small tweaks to federal policy. So, for instance, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act reduced corporate taxes. There were promises of a great boom of investment in the United States, in particular coming from abroad. That largely did not happen. And if you think about it for a moment, it's pretty understandable. Companies could borrow in 2016 and 2017 at a very attractive interest rates, historically low interest rates. And, you know, if you can't find attractive projects when you can borrow at 2 or 2.5%, moving the tax rate down 10 percentage points doesn't really change the profitability of those projects. And so, really, it's the economy is driven a lot more by the market forces than the tax code. However, working in tax, we like to think that's really important. And so often we raise the level of intensity on these issues, but they have, you know, relatively small effects on the overall economy. They could have giant effects on individual companies or sectors of the economy or individual taxpayers, for sure. And that's why many companies and investors have lobbying operations to ensure, like, they're not on the short end of that trade-off. But for the overall economy, the effects probably are not overwhelming.
It only has a major effect on the economics of the lobbyists in Washington, apparently.
those are good jobs. They're high paid.
Yes,
and
I'm sure.
Short.
Right, I'm sure those are definitely work from home jobs as well. Interesting. Well, let me ask you about kind of one other major area that I wanted to touch on, and then we'll throw it open shortly to our audience. I remind the audience again, there's a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen, and you can use that to ask a question, and then we'll draw from that list of questions in the Q&A. So just focusing for a moment on the debt, obviously, we spend more than we raise in taxes and other sources of revenue. In fiscal 2020, at least at the end of fiscal 2020, U.S. debt in public hands, at least as a percent of GDP, was only a little bit below the same number we saw at the peak of World War II. And I know that Congressional Budget Office has projected that by 2050, public debt's going to be 200% of GDP. You have a colleague there, I think, that has written that, you know, on the fiscal front, we are going to look just like Greece, but without the good food and sunshine. So I guess the question to you is that where we're going to end up, or do we have some tricks up our sleeve?
That's a really good question, and it's one that I think economists have been wrestling with in recent years. If you had asked economists a dozen years ago if the economy in the United States had got into a situation where the federal debt to GDP ratio was like 80%, that would have been viewed with alarm. 80 or 100% would be viewed with alarm. And that we've kind of become gradually accustomed to larger amounts of federal debt, and many economists somewhat surprised that the expected rapid increase in interest rates has not occurred. In fact, interest rates have generally declined over that lengthy period as federal deficits have increased. And so economists are rethinking a bit what how they should be looking at this. However, that doesn't mean it's a situation where the federal government can spend as much as it wants without ever worrying about paying things back. You're really in a situation where you're kind of kicking the can, as a country, we're kicking the can down the road to our kids and grandkids to deal with it. And you mentioned earlier the point about $300 billion being paid on interest charges. To the extent that that's being paid to Americans, so you're paying it to yourself, not the world's biggest problem. And that's kind of a situation I think that Japan has, where they have large budget deficits, but much of that is held by Japanese residents and pension funds and so on. And so essentially it circulates within the economy. However, large parts of the U.S. debt are held by foreign holders, and that means that some chunk of that interest payment is not going to benefit U.S. Residents, but actually potentially being used to kind of bid up the cost of buying U.S. things, and so kind of putting a bit of a, making the U.S. somewhat poorer for that. We don't know exactly where the tipping point is, where the debt to GDP ratio is so high that lenders demand additional interest payments. It's probably not a great experiment to run because the downsides of where you find where that tipping point are pretty severe, and so probably would be valuable for the U.S. government to begin to think hard about how are we going to reverse this trend, and that we're in a situation now where we have $1 trillion plus federal deficits, kind of as far as the eye can see, and much larger for the current year. But that's probably not a sustainable long-term position. And so at some point, you know, after the pandemic situation has been resolved, I think the attention on fiscal responsibility will start to rise, and people have to start paying attention to that situation.
All right. That'll be interesting to see how we deal with that, because clearly we've gone a lot further with our debt than many people assumed years ago. So it's become almost a cliche at this point, whether you use the word unprecedented or in uncharted territory.
Yeah,
that can describe a lot of things these days.
No, that's exactly right. I was just thinking like Jason Furman, who used to be head of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama, would, you know, 8 or 10 years ago be worried about 80% debt to GDP ratio, and now you say, well, maybe 150% is okay. And that's just, you know, it's a huge change in just a few years. And that's not unusual for people in the profession.
All right. Well, we obviously will maybe get a chance to see how that plays out. We're starting to get some inbound questions from our audience, so I wanted to at least cede the floor to our listeners.
Okay.
So the first question is coming from a client, and the question basically is, you know, if there is Democratic control, and I'm assuming this means if there is effectively a unified control under a Democratic administration. There's been some recent tech antitrust. I don't know if that's an area where you have an opinion, But the client is asking if you've thought about that and whether there would be consequences of that for those tech actors. You know, if that's outside your bailiwick, just let me know.
Yeah, that's a bit outside my understanding, but I mean, that's an important point to make, in that, you know, here we're talking about debt and fiscal policy. There are, you know, dozens of other policy areas that a new administration would have a major role in. And we have seen congressional Democrats holding hearings on concentration in the tech industries. That has been a long-standing concern. And so it's quite possible that could become a top-tier issue.
What would you think of that issue, even if there were a divided government? Again, I know this might be a little bit from the sidelines of your main focus, but is mm-hmm. there enough broad political support even in a divided government?
So if by divided government you mean with a Democratic presidency, then it's certainly something that would be on the radar screen of incoming people at Justice, the antitrust division there, and any appointees at the Federal Trade Commission. But you know, these things do take a bit of a while to germinate and kind of take off. So I think there'd be a fairly long runway to see how this was proceeding. But that's certainly the case that if there was a Democrat administration, it would be a somewhat different view about the role of I guess, monopolies in kind of air quotes in the tech industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's see. I have another client kind of circling back to the same issue of a blue wave. And I know earlier in our discussion we talked about the economic challenges of January 2021, possibly reordering priorities. But if you looked at the Democratic plan right now, even in light of what might be the challenges in January, what specific items of the Biden tax plan would you still view as having a high likelihood of getting passage, you know, let's say in the first Congress that would sit under a Biden administration?
Yeah, so I think that probably the right way to think about that would be to break policy to those that would more likely have a stimulative effect and then those that might have effect of an economic drag. And on the stimulative effect side, so the proposals that the Vice President has for expanding the child tax credit, making it refundable, having the tax credits for first-time home buyers and things like that, you could easily see those being enacted in a first term, almost regardless of the state of the economy, because if the economy is not doing well, there's going to be demand for stimulus and relief type of activities, and those could easily form part of that. On the longer-term trend, kind of raising taxes, longer-term trend would be to raise taxes on high-income individuals and corporations, and I think the approach would probably be to see when you think the economy is strong enough to bear some of that and then kind of roll it out, but also roll it out in conjunction with the investment programs of the new administration. And so to make things at least a little more palatable, it's not just about raising revenue, but it's about raising revenue to use it for these important investments, whether it be investments in the education of the population or investments in healthcare or investments in improving infrastructure or whatever.
Okay, so the good stuff, the stimulative stuff, kind of the
it's like dessert comes before spinach, right?
Right. Life is short, serve dessert first. Okay. Very interesting. So, again, for our listening audience, on the right side of your webinar screen. Please feel free, drop a question in there. Okay, we're getting one that is probably near and dear, certainly to the people listening in the New York City area, or people who are, you know, focused on the mortgage market. What about developments in the state and local tax deduction or the mortgage interest deduction? What's the latest on those two fronts?
So I think on the mortgage interest deduction, I don't think I've seen anything that was exactly on point for the from the Biden administration. There are some proposals to impose a 28% limit on all itemized deductions, and so that would be a bit of a haircut for mortgage interest deductions for high-income people, along with other itemized deductions. But nothing kind of across the board. On the state and local tax deduction side, though, the Biden administration's been a little inconsistent on what they would propose there. There have been some mentions of repealing the $10,000 annual cap on the state and local tax deduction, and then other times where they've kind of been silent on that issue. That's one I think that would depend on two things, I guess. One, having control of both houses and the presidency would make it at least possible for a Biden administration to propose doing that. But they also are quite aware of the distributional consequence of doing that, and that the benefits of the of relaxing or repealing the $10,000 cap generally go to folks with incomes $200,000 and above, so kind of the top 5 or 10% of the income distribution. And so that's kind of goes counter to the points made earlier about the underlying theory of the Biden tax increases, which are that large corporations and individuals aren't paying their fair share. And so providing a tax cut for high-income individuals may be part, you know, as by addressing the limit on state and local taxes, may be part of a larger plan, but that larger plan would probably raise taxes on high-income individuals.
Okay, so
you might get a deduction, but you'll pay more.
Got it. Yeah, would be politically popular in their at least traditional geographic area, but it doesn't exactly fit with the policy puzzle.
Yeah, no, it's kind of interesting too. And with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you know, there were so many moving parts that I think many people who lost their state and local tax deduction may have ended up with a net tax cut. But there are so many pieces moving around that it's hard to weigh off the almost elimination of the alternative minimum tax with the change in standard deduction, with the change in state and local tax deductions. And so just kind of taking all those provisions into effect, people may have lost one or two things. They may have ended up ahead on balance.
Okay. Here, I'm getting another question. So I guess at various points in the multiple campaigns over the last year, there's been discussion occasionally of a financial transactions tax. What really is going on there? I mean, why is that an area where there's interest, and what's the thumbnail sketch of why that would or would not be kind of a good route?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So we have financial transactions tax already, right? There's a Securities Exchange Commission fee on shares of stock that are traded. It's small, right? Very small. But it probably raises around $1 billion a year, a little bit more for the Securities and Exchange Commission. So it's not like we don't have a financial transactions tax. However, folks like Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, when they were looking at financial transactions taxes, they were looking at things that might have been 50 times or 100 times the size of the current fee. So much larger than we have in place right now. And the feeling, I think, for people who support this is that, one, has a potential to raise a lot of money, or two, it has a potential to reduce trading volumes of people, of investors who are trying to take advantage of relatively small price movements. And so some view those as not very productive trades. It is kind of interesting that some of the proponents think that they're going to both reduce the trading volume of inappropriate trades and raise a lot of money. Both of those can't happen because reduced trading volume, there's not that many trades to tax. But the theory is that there is a lot of trading volume that's inappropriate, and that a tax on trades would be borne by investor class or traders. The counter argument is that many of those trades benefit retirement plans, or assets that are held by not necessarily folks in the top couple percentage points of the income or wealth distribution. And so it becomes a balancing act. And I think from the Biden approach, they have a financial risk fee that they want to impose on large institutions as a way to kind of address the potential risk that they impose on a system. And there have been others who have talked about doing a financial transactions tax as a way to raise the burden on high-income folks as well. Personally, I think that you might be able to double or triple the SEC fee and raise some money without having negative effects, but the larger you make the fee, the harder it is to collect because investors will have incentives to either move trades to other locations where it's not subject to tax or to essentially create or use a financial engineering to find ways around the tax, which doesn't help anybody.
Is there any precedent for that? Are there markets that have financial transactions taxes?
In other countries, yes. I think it can work if you have like if you're the only place or the only convenient place to trade, you can take as a government, you can collect some of those revenues. But if the New York Stock Exchange tried to impose a tax and no one else did, folks would just move somewhere else. You should be aware of that possibility.
Okay. One or two others here. Kind of circling back on some of the details that I guess were attached to some of the stimulative proposals in the Democratic plan. You mentioned first-time home buyers. I guess there's some effort to accommodate students and do something with student loans. Is that on your radar?
There is a proposal. And this was one that I think Senator Warren has supported for a while. But the idea would be to take student loan forgiveness and exclude that from taxable income. So right now, under current law, if a person has a debt and that debt's forgiven, it counts as taxable income to the beneficiary in the year that the debt's forgiven. And so in the case of student loan debt, if individual has $20,000 of student loan debt and the holder of that debt forgives it, that's $20,000 of income to the individual. In a situation coming out of the Great Recession, we have a lot of former students who have large amounts of debt, in some cases larger than really that they are capable of paying in any reasonable time frame. One approach would be to find ways to reduce that debt burden by forgiving portions of that debt And if that occurs, it would normally be taxable income. In the Biden plan, they have a proposal to have that income tax forgiven on that debt forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then here's one on commercial real estate. I guess I take it from the Democratic plan there's some interest in changing the way commercial real estate is taxed.
Yes, yeah, so in the Biden plan, they have a proposal to, I think that the shorthand is like repeal in, inappropriate tax incentives for real estate investment. And so typically when people think about that, they think of things like depreciation on real property that's in excess of the decline in value, the economic depreciation. And also they look to things like the passive loss rules that are in place. If this is one of the areas where I think the provisions are not all that well defined, and also where the Biden campaign's insistence on limiting tax increase to just those with income over $400,000 come into conflict, because if you're going to say that real estate investments don't get, say, the benefit from accelerated depreciation or depreciation faster than the property declines in value, and the properties are held by flow-through entities like a limited liability company or a subchapter S corporation or even as a sole proprietorship or as a partnership, The business entity doesn't know whether the owners necessarily will have income of more or less than $400,000 and try to figure out what the right tax treatment is. So it's just hard to figure out how you could make something like that work in practice. But the goal is to sort of push against inappropriate investments in real estate. Largely, I guess that was addressed in the 1986 Tax Reform Act with things like passive loss rules, but there's concern that there are some benefits that, that may still be unwarranted there.
Okay. I think I'm going to take the honor of effectively the last question. And I want to step back a little bit. I know we've been we've been talking about the differences between the political parties, and it's clear that a lot of these are changes on the edges, as you've described them before. I mean, very meaningful for the individuals, the businesses, potentially the asset classes that are directly affected, but, you know, maybe not on the macro front. But in the tax circles, are there kind of major issues that are where tax experts such as yourself, your colleagues, are trying to slowly bring about major changes in the way the U.S. taxes things? I mean, along the lines of value-added taxes and things of that sort. Is there a big, long-run ask that tax experts are chasing at this point?
No, that's a really good question. And for many years, people in the tax profession have been talking about the wisdom of having a consumption tax of some form, whether it be a value-added tax or in the run-up to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Republicans in the House floated an idea of a destination-based cash flow tax, which was a form of consumption tax collected by businesses, or even something like a carbon tax, which would tax a major source of consumption, obviously just the energy, largely the energy sector, but still a major source of consumption. And part of the reason for doing that is that one reason is that from a tax policy perspective, you like having a portfolio of revenue sources rather than just one or two. And you see, I think that in particular in state governments where if they have an unbalanced tax system, it may be overly reliant on things like income from investment gains. And then you see revenues kind of go up and down dramatically, whereas if you have a more balanced system with income taxes and excise taxes and consumption taxes, you may see less fluctuation over time. And the U.S. is an outlier. We're the only country among all the developed countries without a broad-based consumption tax. I guess the downside of it is the conventional wisdom, I think, in Congress is that every political party in the world that's proposed a consumption tax has been voted out of office, and so no one wants to be first doing it. So it makes it a bit of a big lift.
Yeah, that would definitely be a race you would not want to win, at least as a politician.
Yep.
Okay. That's really fantastic. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground, Mark. So I greatly appreciate it. For our listeners, this really wraps up today's call, Election 2020 Implications for Taxes and Federal Spending. We have 20 days until the election. Remember to vote. And as always, good luck in the markets. And that's it for today. Thanks again, and bye-bye.
Thanks.